You know, it's the magazine business, and we're independent. You can think on your feet, follow your instinct. That's all I did. I changed things all the time. I was relentlessly a pencil and a rubber and the flat pan, rubbing it out, moving stuff, reinventing sections, renaming sections, dropping sections, inventing new ones, looking at content and thinking, how can I frame this up for the readers, you know? I'm Nick Logan, and I'm the founder editor of the Face magazine, which I launched in 1980 as an independent publication, intended to be a youth culture magazine, very successful with a worldwide reputation. I owned the company until the year 2000, so I did 19, 20 years there, and then I sold it to a bigger publishing company, and the magazine closed about 3 years after that. I previously worked with two big publishers, editing The Enemy for one and creating and launching Smash Hits for another one. I wanted then to get away from big publishers. I had the notion of producing a youth culture magazine that was aimed at a wider reach as possible, the circulation of a mainstream title, but independent. I could call the magazine what I wanted to call it. It could go wherever I wanted it to go. And I knew from the beginning that I wanted to broaden the content out to the extent that anywhere there were new ideas that I thought the readers would be interested in, I would cover them. Initially, it was mainly music as a means of establishing the title, because there was no market for a unisex magazine of that type, only special interests, sort of hobby interests, aimed at boys or girls. Angling or motorbikes or, you know, girls' magazines. Yeah, I mean, I was doing it independently because I thought that was the way to get something established that could evolve and have a life of its own without anybody looking over my shoulder, that it would be suited to my own personal talents, you know, such as they were. They were good in some areas and not so good in others. And one of them where they weren't so good was dealing with committees and management. So that's the first part of the story. There were certainly the younger titles were patronising and insulting. And that's why I wanted to do Smash Hits, the magazine I did before the phase. I wanted to put it on decent quality paper and try and do something with a bit of integrity. I know it sounds a bit pompous to say it, but the knowledge and the expertise, I suppose, you know, that I'd gained doing The Enemy, I could put into this new magazine, The Face, using also the knowledge that I gained on Smash Hits of colour reproduction, photographers working in colour, which at that time, most of that material was going outside the UK because there wasn't a publication that could print, you know, that was interested in printing it. Things that I covered in The Face, and I think of Jean-Paul Goude's images of Grace Jones, incredible stuff. I think of the funeral of Bob Marley, which I'm very proud to say that, you know, I covered black and white shots, actually I think some colour, from Jamaica, of a funeral of a legend. Nobody else was doing that stuff. I mean, that's extraordinary. You know, now it would be in the Telegraph style supplement, being all the colour supplements, but both those things, I wouldn't have got near them. And it was just incredible that there was all this material that no one was taking any interest in, or wasn't able to reproduce it properly, or just wasn't culturally of interest to them. You know, this is well before rock album reviews appeared in mainstream media, you know, hard to understand and explain that now. It did really well on the first issue. I printed 75,000 copies. They were distributed all around the country, even a few overseas, I think, straight away. It was Jerry Dammer's The Specials that I felt I owed a debt to. They were in two-tone as a musical phenomenon and also a very photographic subject. It was a big inspiration for starting the magazine, so they were on the front cover. And it sold 57,500, I think, which is extraordinary. Virtually no promotion. I think a half page in the Evening Standard. And I had one ad that I was going to run in The Enemy, but The Enemy was on strike, as was Melody Maker, which possibly made it a little bit easier for me, but no other promotion. The, you know, the normal pattern of launching into the mainstream is that you start at a certain level and you expect to drop back because people sample it, but not everybody likes it. So you drop back, maybe 30%, maybe even 50% from your original starting figure, and then you hope to build from there to gradually reach whatever your optimum circulation is, depending on how good the magazine is. So I had this great start, and then it started to fall back, and it started to fall back a little bit further than I was initially being told by my distributor. So I was printing too many copies and a lot of waste. And because I'd started with my own money, my wife and I, our savings of, I think, something like £3,750 to produce the first issue, we were looking at, you know, a disaster because we were printing twice as many as we were selling. It was a struggle financially for at least 18 months, and it was a struggle artistically because I couldn't get the magazine, the character of it, to come through in the way I wanted. I was trying stuff. I was the only, well, even though I wasn't an employee, I wasn't taking any money, but I was the only full-time person working on it, with a part-time art director who had to return to his full-time job. We were one or two people in a room. I was doing the layouts and the covers with a bit of help, maybe. One of the things that happened was that the New Romantics came along in club culture. And that was a new thing to cover, photographic, photogenic. Seen the Face as a document of its time, like Time magazine or Parry Match, a record of youth culture evolving. The Inky Music Press were too snobbish to cover them. They weren't in their remit, so give me a free hand. So that was one thing that started to make a bit of a difference. When I got a proper art director, when I kind of fired myself as art director and got Neville Brody to come in, then the magazine started. I then got two or three other people, really good writer-editors. We all did everything. We all worked together, commissioning, subbing, writing headlines, proofing copy, passing pages, everything. When Neville came in, which was about 2 months, 2 years down the line, but I thought, yeah, this is going to work now. Made the magazine just so assured. It's just Neville's vision. It was just so good. It just typefaces, a visual identity for the magazine, as well as at the same time as we were developing a textural identity. The thing about The Face was that going out on a limb like that, giving people good paper, best that we could afford, good reproduction, you know, up to the quality of the Tatler or Vogue. We attracted good writers, we attracted good photographers. I mean, people like to see their work used and designed in a nice way, you know, that's going to stay around for a month or longer, not be, you know, thrown away, not fish and chip paper. So photographers, some of whom were quite illustrious at the time they came to us, others who've become so since, were so happy to see their work reproduced so well. Sometimes they would come and say, well, I've worked for you for nothing. Never quite worked out like that because they kind of overlooked the fact that they'd send you all the expenses, you know. So, and we were never a big budget, you know. We never had a lot of money to spend. We did incredible things on small budgets or other people's budgets. The thing that you prove, if you make that effort, if you put something out there that is trying, as far as the reader's concerned and the contributor, you know, people do respond to it, and talent will come to you. What The Face became, because, yeah, it did change. That was the whole point, you know, to let it evolve. It was a magazine about ideas, and those ideas could come from anywhere, you know. They could come from Milan or Liverpool. They could come from the football terraces or an atelier in Paris, you know, and that was fantastic. The reputation of the magazine, which, you know, achieved really good overseas sales all through its life, could grab the attention of people in Paris and Milan, where previously in this country, you know, we'd been looking elsewhere for, like, you know, while America's got the music and the fast food, and, you know, Milan's got the fashion and Paris has got, you know, it made those people look at Britain, you know, take notice of what was going on here, you know, advertise their products and pay money to run lovely images of, you know, beautiful clothes and help you to balance the books at the end of the day, which we always did. Never borrowed any money. I just approached each issue as a kind of housekeeping thing. You only spent what you got. I can't remember exactly when we changed. The first one was a bit like the Cinzano logo. I really liked the way Parry Match did it, or paparazzi sort of shots. I mean, that wasn't a dirty word then. I tried to do a similar kind of thing with the specials and Madness on the beat in the first issue. it was a kind of French thing. When Neville started, he wanted to change the logo straight away, quite radically changed it and put it on the side of the magazine. That's an indication of how confident I was feeling at the time, because every magazine it was accepted had to have the logo across the top. Might be the only thing you could see when things were stacked. Here's another thing. When I first started the place, and I'm talking to a distributor, it's an independent distributor, where's the magazine displayed? You know,
I don't know.
You know, given that it's going to go into Smith's and Menzies all around the country, it's not just here in the West End, you know, specialist bookshops, it's going out everywhere. Where can it be displayed? It can't go next to the Inkies, because they're the wrong, you know, Melody Maker Enemy Sounds was around there, because it doesn't belong with them, it's the wrong shape. The nearest thing was The Economist and Private Eye, you know, which doesn't make any sense. But there's nowhere, you know, whereas now if you go to a bookshop, maybe, you know, go back 10 years, and you'd see whole sections of rock or film and fashion. But then it was like, well, weird, you know, where does this belong? I wasn't interested in doing some small 5,000 print and, you know, a couple of thousand sales. And I wanted to reach out to people like myself, you know, didn't live in Chelsea and Notting Hill and might have read Ritson. Most people possibly think that the first thing you think of when you're approaching an issue is you think of the cover and work from that. It's hardly ever like that. You might be lucky enough to kind of have something in mind, but you don't know that you're going to get the right shot from it, or that you're maybe even going to get the shoot come together. I mean, famously, there's the killer cover, the shot of Felix the Kid, 14-year-old, by Ray Petrie and Jamie Morgan. Yeah, I mean, that's memorable because I really had to push myself to run that image. I didn't know that we were strong enough yet to take a chance. And hadn't run many fashion-only covers, mainly with music and film. And we were very tentative how we're dealing with fashion. We didn't want to call it fashion, that's why we called it style. Thought it was a non-pretentious word to use. Then, you know, got co-opted into style magazines and a dirty word, but when we used it, it was more down to earth than fashion. So we were kind of tentatively exploring what we might do. I'd always been interested in clothing element. Part of the visual element was the clothing that people are wearing. That was as important to me as the music they were making. I'm not just talking about musicians, obviously, but, you know, kids going to clubs, dressing up to go out for the night. To put a 14-year-old on it, wearing the hat with the word killer on the rag out from the magazine, was taking a chance. The news agents could have refused to take it because of that word and what was it was saying. And the readers could have thought, well, what is this? This is a 14-year-old kid. I don't get this. But he looked so sharp. It was so good. I had to be persuaded by other people on the staff, the side of me that said, we're not in the clear here yet. I'm still working to get people to understand what this is. But I'm so pleased I took the chance. The Kate Moss Summer of Love cover that was born out of a lack of a cover, a first cover. In fact, it's not, because we did one 2 months earlier. No one remembers that because it wasn't very good. We weren't sure what to put on the cover. We were getting close to the deadline. And then these fashion images of Kate on the beach. You know, we're not Vogue. You don't just put anyone on the cover. There's a theme there, which is the third Summer of Love, because there was a festival and there was other pieces. Planning it for about 3 hours before it went to the printers. And they're the best covers, really. There were rivals that popped up against the face. And I always treated them as enemies. They were a threat. I mean, there was EMAP, which is the company that published Smash Hits, and if they'd taken an interest in it, might have actually been the publishers of The Face instead of telling me to go away. They put out a rival called New Sounds, New Styles. ID came out 9 months after The Face, so we were pretty much contemporaries. But then Blitz came along, and our relationship with Blitz was kind of was that of rivals. Sleaze Nation, Dazed and Confused. And then people started to get, at a later stage, our competitors started to pick at us, which I found really frustrating, not very pleasant. As things, I mean, towards the end of The Face, things were getting difficult for me. I had kind of overreached myself in launching two other magazines, in addition to The Face and Arena. And the market was getting tough, and the economic situation was difficult. The fact is, I mean, The Face, you know, people think of The Face as being a success. It certainly wasn't all through its lifetime. I've already said how difficult it was right at the beginning, but then there was a period around the turn of the 90s, which wasn't caused by, but coincided with me having a lot of time out because I had bone cancer. And then we had the Jason Donovan libel action brought against us. At that point, Arena was kind of supporting the face. Arena was doing well and helping the face find its feet again, which it did. The same thing happened when Arena was having a struggling period, then the face was doing well. And it's never going to be plain sailing. I never had to go and answer to anybody. I could get a 10-page story about anything and say, oh, I really want to put that in the magazine, but we've only got 132 pages this month. Oh, I'm going to add 8 pages. I'm going to add 16 others. I'm going to add another section just to get these images in, to round out the magazine, because I didn't want to wait. And then I go to my ad manager and I say, oh, look, I've put on another 16. Can you see what you can do? You know, but whether we got the money or not, you know, there was never any bottom line, I suppose is what I'm saying. We certainly influenced the colour supplements, you might say, not in a good way, but that's not my fault. all the style supplements that started appearing. But the face was prepared to take chances, you know. We got involved with 7 or 8 other magazines in Europe, one in, you know, each country, from Italy, France. We did a joint issue with them. I mean, it wasn't the easiest thing to do. It wasn't the most successful thing to do. It was a pan-European cross-cultural exchange, a bit too worthy, to be honest, and not every one of the other magazines had enough in common to make it work. But a very noble effort, you know. You know, it riles me when people say, you know, the face was elite. You know, we were as interested in the casual wear fashion coming from the terraces in Liverpool or Leeds as we were in Sotsas, Memphis furniture from Milan. No one on the face owned a single piece of Memphis. It's too expensive. Ideas could come from anywhere. It's a nice feeling to drive into work and, like, almost anything you think of, like, you know, sort of see something on the way in, which I did once in the Hackney Road. I noticed that a lot of the pubs had turned into looking like discos, black frame painted fronts. That's before they became the strip clubs. Is that just the Hackney Road, or is there something going on here? And it was kind of like disco pubs. It was a very short-lived phenomenon where people were dancing on the bars and just having a good time. The fact that you could, you know, just see it on the way to work, get someone to go and investigate and write a piece, that was great. And somebody else might come in who's been thinking about Italian design. You know, one of my staff come in. Ideas could come from everywhere. It wasn't an ego-centred magazine. I don't think anyone could do it again. If you're always honest about what you're doing and you employ people who know how to write and communicate, you establish that trust, then the readers will follow you. They will read the piece about Italian design, or they'll read about an interview with AJP Taylor or anything. You know, you can take them anywhere. That was my philosophy at the NME. Establish trust, and that takes time. And it is a community thing. I mean, it's like Facebook before Facebook. It's not going to appeal to everybody. It may only be like 10 people in a town or one person in a village who's interested in that. Make them feel like they're part of a community everywhere. And the NME was very much like that. It's done by building trust over time and being honest. And it's the same with the face. People who felt connected to the face felt connected to each other. And I hear fantastic things about how it changed people's lives, you know. I was inspired by the fact that a footballer on a coach going to a game would pass it around amongst his teammates, you know, which I found out happened way back. I didn't know at the time. I'm inspired as much by that as I am that Giorgio Armani says, what is this magazine we've got to advertise there, or what are these people doing? The collectability of the magazine, yeah, I was aware of that. I was very conscious that, you know, potentially being part of youth culture history.